We're at the very end of chapter 1 in James. He says, if anyone thinks himself to be religious and yet does not bridle his tongue but deceives his own heart, this man's religion is worthless. Pure and undefiled religion in the sight of our God and Father is this: to visit orphans and widows in their distress and to keep oneself unstained by the world. So that's about as brief of a statement as one could make. And to be so very full of different aspects. Very broad in its thing. Religious, the adjective here is, this is the only time it's used in the New Testament. The corresponding noun is found in Acts 26:5, Colossians 2:18, and also in the end of this verse where it says religion, and in 1:27 where it says religion. So it's used, you know, a few times where it talks about religion, about four times where it's translated religion, the noun aspect. But the descriptive aspect of it is only used here where it says religious. Its focus is on religious performance. You know, so it's denoting here the sense of zealousness and diligence in the outward or ceremonially aspect of worship. So there's an outward, you know, it's looking at being religious in the sense of presenting oneself, how one presents themselves. Now, exactly what James had in mind, you know, in the sense of precisely what outward practices James had in mind, we're not sure of. But you could look at the things that were common at that time and think they would have at least included all of those things, such as prayer and fasting and attendance at worship services. Those would be observable religious things, such as how they would have known, you know, to the details. They knew it with Daniel. Daniel would have been outwardly religious, though we also know that he was more than just outwardly religious, but they knew that he prayed. One's patterns, so from that would be the sense of religious, because they have these patterns, outward behaviors, practices that show themselves to be compatible with that thought. So it's, you know, we tend to use religious in a negative way most often than it's used anymore. It tends to have that a negative connotation about it. If somebody said you're religious, most often that would be a compliment. A synonym, basically, in our society could be, if they said you were spiritual, you're a deeply spiritual person. But there's something about that implies that it's more than that. Religious in our society is very much like this. That if one is religious, it just is outward. It doesn't, you know, you just have all the looks. Or it's without meaning. That'd be the other way our society would use it. You could be very sincere in all of it, but we just don't believe it. So we say you're religious, you know, a religious nut. Something like that. It's all fraud. Not necessarily that he's a fraud.
King James has been read among you, seen if you're
religious. Yeah, the idea of thinks himself or seems to, it seems to be more, you know, that focus. So here it's, if anyone thinks himself to be religious, so anyone, you know, perceives himself to be religious, but religious is positive here. That's the thing that I guess I'm trying to put. it's a positive term. It's not negative in James's use. So if you perceive yourself to be religious, so you perceive yourself to be, you know, in our terminology, we'd probably be like spiritual or devoted or a disciple. You know, we'd use probably some other term because religious is negative. But the idea here is positive. If you perceive yourself, you think yourself, you seem to be, but or yet you don't bridle your tongue, you're deceiving yourself and your religion's worthless. I mean, James puts that sense of control of your tongue, you know, very, you know, huge here in terms of defining religion or defining that character. Now, that's not to be equated with that if you're a believer, but it is that sense of being perceived to be a man of religion, a man of God, a person of God, but not just in the sense of, you know, that one's doing that just to put on a front. But here he's saying, if you do that and you don't bridle your tongue, you know, you're worthless.
What do you think you're bridling your tongue from? In this case, is it just like vanity? Is it just idleness? This could go as far as a vow of silence, you know, historically.
Yeah, I don't know that it's... I think it's probably very broad as opposed to, you know, something real nice. You know, and since bridle of tongue means, you know, that you cuss. You know, that's it. You know, nothing else. I think it's probably very broad in the sense of...
Back to the cowboy days,
bridle
of your tongue.
That controls the horse. Yeah, and that's what he'll come back to that. And I think it is that, later he uses that very description of the sense of bridler, the rudder on the ship, and about the tongue. And I think it's in that sense that, you know, Jesus, and we talked about this a little bit last week, Jesus says, you know, paraphrases, what comes in isn't what defiles you, it's what goes out. And that's in that idea of, you know, you're in control of that. So if you're bridling your tongue, then you have that self-control. So I don't think it would be, I've got self-control in the area of cussing or not, but I think it's that broad sense of use of your tongue. So you could, you know, what would be the ways, even biblically, what are the ways that one, what are the different exhortations about our speech patterns or our tongue in Scripture?
Cussing.
There would be that aspect, you know. It talks about not malice and slander, which would be, forms, I guess, of lying. I mean, a lot of these would be offshoots of something at some level. So, thank you. Those would be the things you look at. There was a. Now, this would be a little more specific to one area, but there when I was. I'd been coaching about, I guess, 4 years, and we had a, when I was, first out of college, and we were at Millshue, and there was a well-known, at that time, I don't even remember who he was, but he was a college, coach that was, had become very popular on the speech circuit that year, and so he's going, various schools, there were athletic banquets, and he'd become very popular. He's supposed to be this very good speaker, and we had our athletic director and head football coach had left, and we a new one had just been hired, and you know, Mike had nothing to do with planning this or anything, the athlete, you know, banquet, all that's in motion, that's all set, and he gets there, and he's there about a week before this banquet. Well, everybody's excited about this because, you know, he had kind of this big-name guy coming in for him. And Mike was just real quiet about it, and it showed no excitement or whatever. And the guy gives his speech and so forth, and his speech was, you know, it was excellent. You know, I mean, it's one of those that would be, you know, almost timeless, you know, because a lot what it was about was exactly this, you know, controlling your tongue. You know, I don't remember how he put it all, but it was, you know, about, you know, basically saying, if you're cussing, then you just don't have a brain or whatever, you know. Neil, those kinds of things, you know. Well, you know, a couple few days later or something, I'm not sure how the conversation got there, but, you know, Mike was, you know, as the conversation went on, he's, you know, he just didn't have any respect for the guy because he had been at it where his dad was an administrator. He had been there just a few weeks before to their athletic banquet when this guy spoke. And in the back room where all the other coaches were after this deal, he said this guy had the worst, you know, mouth there was, you know. And so it was, you know, so there's, you know, if you don't know it, you know, then, you know, what he says is good. But if you have the other, it, you know, it's more than just, it doesn't make it neutral. It doesn't wipe it out. It goes the other way. Well, that's kind of what he's saying here. You know, not about that one thing, but he's saying about everything. If you don't have it, then it makes it, you know, worthless. It nullifies it. So all these things that we could put down and say, this is what is religious. And I think the things we could include at least would be those things that are public in nature concerning, you know, what makes one appear to be religious in a positive sense. And here, if you don't bridle your tongue, then it undoes all that. And So there are a bunch of passages. I don't know if we want to look at all of these, but let's look at some of them. If you'll look them up. Let's see. Rob, look up Matthew 12. 33 and 34, Blenda, 1 Timothy 3:8, Wynn, 1 Peter 3:10, John, Ephesians 4:29, and Ephesians 5:6. And can you look them up? Just didn't know. We can't do it. Well, you know, she came in saying she didn't have her brain. That's why I'm asking. So Romans 1:29. Yours was 1 Peter 3:10. Yours was 4:29 and 5:6. And if they don't have anything to do with speech, look around until you find someone that does. Okay, Rob?
Either make the tree good and its fruit good, or make the tree bad and its fruit bad. For the tree is known by its fruit. You brood of vipers, how can you, being evil, speak what is good? For the mouth speaks out of that which fills the heart.
That's incredibly pointed, isn't it? Plus, it calls them brood of vipers. You know, you bunch of snakes there. Jesus wouldn't make it very well on the politically correct circuit, would he? But, you know, then you come to the point of saying, how can you even, you know, speak what's good because you're evil? So that's an interesting approach. Blenda? Well, surely we can do better than that. Is there another verse there that talks about not gossiping or something? Well, oh well. Hopefully we'll do better on next ones. 1 Peter 3:10.
For the one who wants to love life and to see good days, keep his tongue from evil and his lips from
evil. And then the couple of Ephesian passages.
There's no corrupt communication proceeding out of your mouth, but that which is good, the use of it by him may minister grace unto the hearer.
Yours? Romans 1:29. Well, he could possibly be in the right chapter. It wouldn't make any sense. So there's about four terms there. Okay, Belinda, what was yours again? No, is that or either just the wording?
1 Timothy 3:8.
Yeah, you got it. Just read it. Yeah.
Deacons, likewise, are to be men worthy of respect, sincere, not indulging in much wine, but in using their tongues purely for
tongues. Okay, it's the word sincere. The word, you know, in the numeric standard, it's not not double-tongued. And so, which is... Yeah, so we wouldn't, you know, not too often we go around saying, why is a double-tongued person? So, sincere... Hypocritical, those would be more, you know, typical English words. So that's where that one came from. Yeah, we might use that if you watched old cowboy shows. But yeah, that one. But, you know, so we have a lot of, yeah, that's what we you know, the double tongue had been forked tongue, yeah. And that's where that would come from. Well, anyway, so we get the general idea of where there's a lot of those. I'll look at some Proverbs. Rob 10:20-32, Belinda 12:18-19, Wynn 15:2-4, and John 18:21. Oh, I forgot to read my verse a while ago. For I'm afraid, now this is 2 Corinthians 12:20. For I'm afraid that perhaps when I come, I may find you to be not what I wish, and may be found by you to not be what you wish, that perhaps there will be strife, jealousy, anger, tempers, disputes, slanders, gossips, arrogance, disturbances. So, you know, all those are in a negative context. All right, what's Proverbs got to say? Rob?
The tongue of the righteous is as choice silver. The heart of the wicked is worth little. Then the lips of the righteous bring forth what is acceptable, but the mouth of the wicked what is perverted.
Linda?
Well, 18. Reckless words pierce like a sword, but the tongue of the wise brings healing. And not the fruitful lips endure forever, but a lying tongue lasts only a moment.
The tongue of the wise makes knowledge attractive,
It's interesting contrast that that words can heal and that words can hurt. 18:21. Yeah, so that'd be a very close one to what's the verse what James is saying. So as we look at this passage in James, where he says, "If anyone thinks himself to be religious, and yet does not bridle his tongue but deceives his own heart, this man's religion is worthless." We could look at this at in terms of pure religion, that it's an avenue of true religion. Focuses or concerns our tongue. So one of the avenues is, it's about a tongue that is bridled, I guess you could say. A second one in the next verse, we might say, avenue of true religion, focuses on those that are helpless or those that are less fortunate or the unfortunate. For he says, pure and undefiled religion in the sight of our God and Father is this, to visit orphans and widows in their distress. So there's an aspect of pure religion is about bridle tongue. Pure religion is about helping those that are needy, helping those that are less fortunate, helping those that are unfortunate. I think there's aspects of this that would always be true when it says orphans and widows. But notice it says in their distress, visit orphans and widows in their distress. But some of that is going to be affected by society. Widows and orphans in general, just as a statement of fact, are not necessarily in a great deal of distress, being helpless or in a terrible position in the United States. At the time of this writing, widows had no way of making a living. They had no provisions. Orphans, there wasn't anyone to take care of them. So if you go around the world, a large part of the world, that would still be true. There are certain provisions for people in the United States. So the fact that you're a widow, are there needs? In the sense of relationships are broken and, lost and things like that. There's all kinds of needs there. But as far as being needy in a material sense, provisions for it, a person, a widow could be extremely wealthy in our society. If she wasn't wealthy, could be very capable of making a very good living. Orphans, obviously, there's a significant need, but, there's much more of a provisions for providing for kids and having them adopt. I'm not trying to say that if a kid's an orphan, there's no issues. I'm saying it's not as severe in our society in those areas as it was at the time of this writing or that it would be in other parts. But it's, so I don't know that the focus should be on widows and orphans as much as what does that group represent. It represents people that are helpless, people that are unfortunate, people that are in need. Those would always be great examples of that in any situation. But if we only looked at that, then we could look at it and say, well, I don't know any widows that are in need, and I don't know any orphans, so there's nothing for me to do. But it, you know, it's broader than that, looking at the you know, those that are less fortunate. And you know, some passages that deal with that. Eva, if you'd look up Isaiah 1:10, it's really a kind of a long passage, 1:10 to 17. Rob, Deuteronomy 14:29, 14:29, Deuteronomy. And Blenda, Deuteronomy 24:17 to 22. And Jeremiah 5:28, when? And John, Acts 6:1-6. Isaiah 1:10-17. Okay, if you have a real long passage, you might want to kind of look over it and well, always make sure it's right. But I was thinking, look over it and summarize it, or you know, as opposed to having to read it the whole passage. Like I have one that's in 1 Timothy 5:3-16. I don't think I'm going to read 3-16 to you, so but pick out some of the things that it's looking at. Eva? Ten to 17.
Hear the word of the Lord, you rulers of Sodom, Sodom. Give ear to the laws for God, the people of Gomorrah. To what purpose is the multitude of your sacrifices to me, says the Lord? I have had enough of burnt offerings of rams and the fat of fed cattle. I do not delight in the blood of bulls or of lambs or of goats. When you come to appear before me, who has required this from your hand, to trample my court. Bring no more futile sacrifices, incense is an abomination to me. The new moon, the Sabbath, and the calling of assembly, I cannot endure iniquity and the sacred duty. Your new moons and your appointed feasts, my soul hates. They are a trouble to me. I am weary of bearing them. When you spread out your hands, I will hide my eyes from you. Even though you make many prayers, I will not hear. Your hands are full of blood. Wash yourself, make yourself clean. Put away the evil of your doings from before eyes. Cease to do evil, learn to do good, seek justice, rebuke the oppressor, defend the fatherless, and plead for the widow.
Mm-hmm. So there, I mean, the first part of it was very clear about kind of this, kind of what James, you know, that's a very close passage of what James is saying in the sense of outward show. And God's saying, I'm not concerned about all your new ways to worship. But then at the end, it gets very focused on, you know, caring for the helpless.
Well, and that one, they use the term fatherless rather than orphan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 And, you know, one of the interesting things there as you're talking about, you know, and I think it probably has to do, you know, I'm not a sociologist, but in any form or shape or concept, but in when life is about survival, then having a father is important for the purpose of having meals and a shelter and so forth. In our society, generally speaking, you know, the absence of a father doesn't mean that you're going to starve to death. Lots of people struggle in that area of not, you know, not knowing who, you know, feeling abandoned, things like this. So, you know, divorce at, you know, when kids are a certain age, they, you know, some kids feel very abandoned. And so there could be a lot of other issues that go along with those things, not just. Rob, what'd you come up with?
Well, I'm going to go ahead and read 28. At the end of every third year, you shall bring out all the tithe of your produce, and that year shall deposit in your town. And the Levite, because he has no portion or inheritance among you, and the alien, the orphan, and the widow who are in your town, shall come and eat and be satisfied, in order that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hand which you do.
Okay, so there's that provision for the widows. Belinda?
Mine just the verses that talk about leaving extra around your field and not going back over.
Okay.
In order that the widows and fathers and the aliens will have provision.
And that would have been the issue, you know, where Ruth was able to go glean, it was because of this practice to provide.
The other thing it says previously on here is remember you were slaves in Egypt. Remember you were slaves in some time, like, and then for us to be gracious to you, you couldn't be gracious to us.
And when?
And that's always really stuck with me. I'm not a farmer. It's different out there. But just that somebody would do that kind of thing. And I've heard a lot this summer about encouraging people who garden to, like, plant an extra row and take that food to food banks and things like that. So if you're out there gardening, you know, once an extra row.
Rob and
I, just as dead as the other. Yeah, I was going to say, you're like my garden, and just the worms had more to eat. The bugs had, and there were more bugs to feed.
Was it when you lived in D.C.? No. I don't remember you doing that.
She hasn't told you all of her experiences. Okay, John?
Of God and set a table. Wherefore, brethren, look among you for sin and the water people.
Well, in the Timothy passage, 1 Timothy 5, the first half of it talks about widows. He says, honor widows who are widows indeed. And then through this passage, it would seem that he's defining widows indeed as those that have no other recourse. You know, if they have children, grandchildren, there's somebody to provide for them. If they're young, he encourages them to remarry. And then at the end he says, if any woman who is a believer, has dependent widows, she must assist them, and the church must not be burdened, so that it may assist those who are widows indeed. So the focus is at the end. I mean, he's saying, if there's other ways people can be taken care of, that's where it should be. But the church should take care of those that, you know, he talks about widows indeed, but that means those that are widows that have no other avenue. So anyway, there are various passages in the Bible that, encourage this sense of helping those that are, in need, those that are helpless. And I think the thing, to restate here, I think the issue with widows and orphans is in the society, the time that the Bible's writing, is that was a group or two groups that were in very bad situation financially. If you were a widow, there just wasn't. Women didn't make money. That would be different than our setting. A third avenue of true religion then would concern moral purity, as James puts there. Talked about the bridal tongue in 26, and he says, pure and undefiled religion in the sight of our God and Father is this, to visit orphans and widows in their distress, and to keep oneself unstained by the world. And there would be some passages here. Rob, if you'll look at 2 Peter 3, 14, and Belinda, 1 Timothy 6, 14, and Wynn, 1 Peter 1, 19. First Peter 1:19. Does that make any sense? If not, we'll move on to something else. Doesn't make much sense to me. It's the double inspired. Verse 18. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. Probably 14 and 15 in there would be the better verses. We'll pretend that that's what it was supposed to be. They work. Okay, Rob, what'd you come up with?
Therefore, beloved, since you look for these things, be diligent to be found by him in peace, spotless and blameless.
Okay. Belinda? And then later in James, in chapter 4, verse 4, he says, you adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is hostility toward God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. So there's that real sense of contrast. So anyway, there are a lot of passages that we could look at on that one. But, as James looks at religion in this sense, he gives us those three avenues. It's not, seeing religion as doing all the outer aspects of religion. And we could say rituals, because there are a lot of those. And I think they, probably become, rituals from, when they're done that way. I think that's one of the things, rituals without reality. He used to hear that phrase somewhat, and that's what it would become. When they're done with this other meaning, then they're not. In our society, we wouldn't call them rituals because they have reality to them. They have meaning to them. But he talks about, the tongue, caring for needy people, and, purity. And that's, even though that's there, you don't tend to hear Christianity defined that way a lot. Now, I'm not talking about how one becomes a Christian, but talking about this is what a devoted follower of Christ is like. We don't necessarily hear it there, but this passage would put it that way. Well, are there prayer requests?